I watch this as an adult, as a podcast where we reminisce about movies from our childhood and we see if it still holds up or we just say, I used to watch this crap. Check out the podcast to see what we say. Peace.
Hello, everyone. Screenplay Archaeology host Kira Midhead here. Before we get into today's episode, I just want to get some intro stuff out of the way. First things first, we are now part of the Fandom Lib Media Podcast Network, so I'm going to link their site down below. And that's why you would have just heard a promo for another podcast, because they're another one of the shows on the network. And as per usual, if you like the show and you'd like to know more, you can check out our social media pages on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and even Instagram now. The show also has a Patreon if you're willing to gift money, but you don't really need to if you don't want to. And we also have a Discord server, which you can join if you want to chat with, you know, the group members there. So that link is going to be down below as well. So yeah, sit back, guys, and enjoy the show. All right, everyone. Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Screenplay Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Kira Midhead, and today I'm going to be bringing you a look at a horror script that I have not covered before. Now, I know we said in the last episode, me and Jake were going to be doing the early drafts of the 2017 Mummy movie, but there's been scheduling issues and other things going on that I don't want to go into any detail about here. They're kind of making that difficult. So I'm going to try and do a series of two, maybe three solo episodes I'm going to be putting out just to sort of, you know, fill space and make sure I'm not doing completely nothing on the podcast front. And the thing I decided to look at first, because I have a guy on the Discord who's always asking me about talking about unproduced horror scripts, so I decided to pick up a horror spec by a writer I really like. I covered one of his scripts on here a few years ago. So we're going to be talking about S. Craig Zahler's Silo, aka Denizens of Filth, which is a horror script about a team that gets sent in to investigate a previously unknown missile silo that had been wiped from the records and the horrors that they find within. That's a good little summary for you right there. Now, Zahler is a guy whose stuff I really, really like for the most part, and the three films he's directed I think are all really good to great. Bone Tomahawk, Brawl in Cell Block 99, and Dragged Across Concrete, and I look forward to whatever he does next. He's got some stuff going on, and the whole Cinestate debacle, that whole thing happened, and that threw off a whole bunch of things, so it looks like Hug Chicken Penny isn't happening. But he's a prolific writer. I covered The Narrow Caves on here a while back, which was also a horror spec, which got turned into a strange little audio drama, which I've listened to and is pretty good, but has some weirdness to it in the way it was adapted. But his movies, really good for the most part. The ones he wrote but didn't direct, I'm more mixed on, because Asylum Blackout, I'll just say the script is better than the movie, because the people who made the movie changed the ending and put in a really stupid plot twist. And Puppet Master: The Littlest Strike is, it's a Puppet Master movie. It's mildly less shit than a lot of the Puppet Master movies, but it was very mean-spirited and kind of just uncomfortable to me. I didn't really care much for it. Like, there was a couple of decent kind of kill scenes in it, but other than that, it was just kind of whatever. And I don't know how much of that was Zahler not really liking writing it or anything, or if he was like given notes. I don't know what the deal is with that, but the movie just wasn't very good, and it ended on a fuck you cliffhanger, which is never ever getting resolved at this point. Seriously, Charles Band will make 16 more Puppet Master movies before that continuity ever gets continued at this point. But yeah, so for the most part, and I've also read four of his five books, and his two westerns, Congregation of Jackals and Rites of the Broken Land, excellent. He did a crime novel called Mean Business on North Ganson Street, which I thought was okay. I mean, I've read five of the six, I should say, because I almost forgot about Corpus Chrome Inc., which is a solid little weird science fiction story. And Hug Chicken Penny was a really interesting stab at writing something that was way outside his wheelhouse. And I was looking forward to the movie, but like I said, between the Cinestate perfluffle and the Henson Company's projects kind of not working out lately, that probably hurt it as well, because they took a big swing with the Happy Time Murders and that bombed. And even though the Dark Crystal prequel series was excellent and award-winning and everybody liked it pretty much, Netflix went, nah, we're not spending money on it, fuck it, so it's canceled. So who knows how that might have affected Hug Chicken Penny. But yeah, but he has a solid list of like unproduced scripts that somehow I have avoided doing hardly any of them. Like I've done Narrow Caves and I'm doing this. Somehow I've not gotten around to doing Brigands of Rattleborge. I have no idea how that happened. But to get into Silo, I don't have any background on this. It's made for a company called, let me look at it. It's got Spitfire Pictures on the title page. Title pages, because there's two of them for some reason. And I looked them up. I don't think they exist anymore because they haven't done anything since 2013. They did a handful, like 7 or 8 projects between movies and TV in between 2009 and 2013. And I couldn't find anything after that, anything about it, anything about this project in particular. So I don't know if this was like a work for hire thing or if he sold it to them. So it would have had to have been written somewhere in there, I'm guessing closer to 2009 than to 2013. That's just, you know, a feeling I get. And just to start with the title, Silo, which is a good one-word title of what it's about, and then you get the AKA Denizens of Filth, which is a much more Zoller-esque title, in my opinion, and sounds like it would make a hell of a name for a metal band, which Zoller is, of course, you know, a member of, I think he's been a member of 2 metal bands, so of course he would know. And so to get into plot, let's just dive right into it. So it opens on a woman named Cynthia, who's driving down a highway in Montana late at night. She's listening to a sermon on the radio, and as she goes to turn into the parking lot of a diner, her headlights illuminate this old man who's covered in lesions, who's crawling over the embankment. So instead of making her turn, she swings over to stop and try to help him, but his lesioned hand grabs her arm, and he tries to speak despite not having a tongue, and he can only make moans. And Cynthia tries to get away from him and bursts one of the lesions on his hand as she attempts to wrench free, unleashing a horde of small gray insects. So already you're getting some nasty fucking imagery, like just the disgustingness that you often get in like a Zoller script, where like it's not super violent yet, but this is totally getting into that kind of territory that he usually does. And so she hits the old man with her free hand, breaking something inside it, and wrenches her hand free. She hits his arm and wrenches her hand free, and fleeing back to her car. And the man who has, like, he's wearing like kind of a mechanic shredded outfit, and he has a tool belt on, and he crawls under a car and he does something to the undercarriage that keeps her from driving away a bit. He like cuts like her brake lines or something, like something to do with, he does something to her pedals. And he then leans on the hood of the car as Cynthia starts honking the horn to attract attention from the people in the diner. And the man pushes the car into the road. And just as people start emerging from the diner, Cynthia and her car are flattened by an 18-wheeler. Now that is one hell of a fucking intro scene. Like, I mean, that would certainly get attention. And I don't know if maybe this is an earlier script of his, and so he's maybe writing to you know, more of a commercial eye, because when you're selling spec scripts, people often will write an intro that's like disposable but catches attention, and so maybe it's meant to be along those lines, but I don't really feel that way about it personally. I think it works pretty well as an intro to the movie. It's pretty insane for a cold open. And so we then go to a New Mexico missile silo, where we are introduced to Kirsten, who's serious and smoking, and then we get Bodell. We get the idea he's a womanizer trying to quit, and he makes like lots of like jokes, like he's constantly wisecracking through this thing, as well as the silo chief Tyler Warren. And the last Peacekeeper missile is in the process of being deactivated, and we get Tyler talking about how his wife wants him to retire, but he's not quite ready yet, and so Kirsten offers him, you know, me and Bodell were doing work inspecting decommissioned missile silos, and hey, maybe come along, lend your expertise to it. And so we get like a sequence of like this thing being deactivated, like they're bringing in all the vehicles, and then they're going like, oh yeah, we gotta go in and like defuse the explosives. And it's a really quick scene. This feels like it's been added in like a revision, and it's not a great introduction to these characters who get introduced later and perfectly effectively, and we learn more about them then. This feels like it's the only person who really benefits from this intro is Tyler, because it gives him that little bit of information about not wanting to retire. Like, it builds his character a little more, but you don't really learn a whole heck of a lot about Kirsten and Bodell that you don't learn later, because Bodell, it's just the stuff you learn later, and Kirsten, you don't really learn anything about her until later anyways. So this scene's a little it's not great, it's not bad. But so from there we go to, it fades to black, and we hear a voice over the black screen. A voice talks about a dream that they've had with himself and an army buddy named Chops checking out a bombed out city in Iraq and finding a bunker with a cannibal terrorist inside who eats Chops before the dreamer wakes up. And then the scene fades in, and we see that we are in the office of psychiatrist Robert Linderman, and the story is being told by a patient, a young Navy man named Philip. And it turns out he feels responsible for Chop's death, despite the fact that he acted impeccably during the combat incident. And Robert prescribes him a sedative and anti-anxiety medication, saying he needs help, needs sleep to begin healing. And you get an idea of the type of psychiatrist Robert is here. He's our hero of the script, by the way. Main character, at least. And he talks about how, like, he doesn't normally believe in handing out medication unless the patient really needs it. And he also talks about how he doesn't really go in for dream analysis. And that's all interesting setup for him. So we're getting to see some decent setup for our main character here. And so later, Robert is met in the park by his wife, Laura, who gives him crap about his clothes looking a little worn. And they go out to dinner at a restaurant called the Silver Plate, where everyone is dressed better than Robert, and they're sat in a dark corner. And they start bickering, and you get the idea that there's like some serious tension in their relationship that we don't really go into fully until later. But Robert only gets truly annoyed and impatient with her when she displays a lack of empathy towards his patients. And later that night, they're shown in bed with Laura already asleep and Robert reading. And the next morning, Robert is met at his office by Major George Dillett and Harry Dearworth, who's the executive of civil engineering. They speak to Robert about the vagrant who was arrested after Cynthia's death. He was believed to have leprosy at first, but the lesions were discovered to be infested with an unknown species of insect, which they managed to root out and exterminate. Did they get Dale Gribble to do that? I wonder. He also has hand-shaped burn marks all over his torso, which he was unable to explain as he has no wits and can't speak. And they've come to Robert because he's a respected military psychiatrist, and the vagrant turned out to be a military man, one who was believed dead for 30 years, and his existence has led to further discoveries. And Harry tells Robert that whatever he learns from here on out is classified information, and he can't even tell his wife about it, and Robert's like, well, yeah, that's not going to be a problem, which I thought was pretty funny. And they want him to fly with them to Fort Ingram and examine the prisoner, because they say that, and then later they're like, well, what's the point? So that's a little strange. And have taken the liberty of telling Robert's secretary to reschedule his appointments for that day. And Robert is told he won't be back this evening and says he has to call his wife to let her know. And they soon board the helicopter to fly out, with Dillett ordering the pilot to get there by 1530, despite the fact that that will make the ride bumpy. Because they say, like, I can get there by 1400. He was like, no, get there by 1530 because we have to meet these people. So yeah, it's going to be a bumpy ride. And so Robert ends up being nauseated by the time they reach the fort. He's just like, this is a shot of him in the helicopter going, which is actually kind of funny. He's soon whisked away to the fort's council room, where Kirsten, Bodell, and Tyler are already waiting. And we learn here that Kirsten is a doctor. She's a radiological specialist. And so we finally get our introduction to her. And Dillett begins to brief the room on the situation, taking time to explain how missile sites in the U.S. started getting deactivated in 1991. An ID card found on the vagrant of a sort that has been used since the 70s, because they say it has like punch cards. It has like holes. It's like a punch card. It identifies him as Ralph Bernard, a maintenance worker in a missile silo previously unknown. And before long, Bernard was claimed by the military and put a gag order on the situation, In the 6 weeks since, conclusions have been reached based more on gaps in the records than any solid information. Basically, they went to look at like all the records and they found that there was stuff suspiciously missing, and they were able to reconstruct the gist by looking at the gaps, which I think is really cool. Namely, that a silo was decommissioned and quickly covered up by somebody high up. And I like this because it doesn't go into like a military conspiracy here. Like, the military people in the modern day are just as surprised by this as anyone else. Like, they don't have a clue either. I think that really adds to the mystery, and it doesn't go in like the cliche direction with that. The silo team recognizes an aerial photo as showing the gangway hatch to the silo, and they've decided to put together a special team to examine the facility with Robert on hand in case they find more people like Ralph Bernard. And Tyler asks if the silo has been properly deactivated, and Dillett admits that they don't know for sure. He also explains that they are to abandon the mission if millirep readings go up above 5,000, so the radiation levels, and introduces the two last members of the team, explosives expert Lieutenant Calvin Jones and the SCARD tactical expert Captain Bjorn Gonnenson, who is to lead the mission. That, what a fucking name. And he's described as having like a scar across the bridge of his nose. And the whole time, even though the guy has like the extremely Scandinavian name of Bjorn Gonnenson, I was just picturing Kevin McKidd from Dog Soldiers in Rome. And Bodell was visibly put off by this, grimacing, which Gonnenson notices. Like, that's a running thing that Gonnenson notices Bodell's behavior and doesn't like it. Like, that's a complete running gag throughout the whole thing. The mission is to begin at 0500 hours the next morning, and in the meantime, they're all free to eat and get some rest. Robert, for his part, wants to see Ralph Bernard so he can know what he might find down there. And we go to Tyler, Bodell, and Kirsten, who eat together in the cafeteria, watching as Calvin and Gonnenson enter and get salads. And Bodell goes like, I knew they were gay. So yeah, there's some not great jokes here. Calvin is somewhat friendly, but Gonnenson makes a show of cutting a slice of roast beef and sits far away from them facing the wall. And so it's like, oh yeah, like establishing tension in like a very simple, straightforward way. And Robert is escorted by Major Dillett to Ralph's room, which is deep below ground. He has been rebandaged in gauze and stares blankly at the ceiling, clicking his teeth. And Dillett tells Robert that the drugs he has been on have had no effect, and tells Robert that talking to him would be a waste of time, before mentioning that they found a whole rat skull in his feces. And he rolls over in bed, and Robert gets to see those hand-shaped burns for himself. That night, Robert calls his wife to tell her he'll be away the entire next day, but gets no answer and has to leave a message. And the next morning, the team gathers outside and all greet each other except for Gonnenson, who is already in the van and revs the engine to get them to hurry up. It's almost kind of comical, that moment. On the drive out to the silo, the team banters with Robert, checking Kirsten's finger, noticing she isn't married. And he mentions his wife. They have like some banter where he talks about, aha, my wife, ha ha ha. And Bodell, after losing his mobile signal and ending his phone sex session, yes, really, he plays a game of chess with Tyler from memory, which is kind of fun. There's some banter there because Tyler's like, oh yeah, Bodell keeps forgetting things, so I'm easily going to win. And around noon, Kirsten and Bodell are asleep in the van when Gonnenson pulls it to a stop in a rocky area. He insists they walk for the last mile and just glares at Bodell when he complains about the idea. And they soon arrive at a 2-foot square depression, and Gonnenson assembles a shovel while Robert and Kirsten banter some more and Tyler and Bodell play more chess. Gonnenson orders them to start digging, complicated by the fact that Bodell didn't pack a shovel. Robert and Kirsten don't have them either, but that's not a problem because Robertson's supposed to be digging and she packed her bag full of the radiological equipment she's going to be using. And this leaves Tyler, Calvin, and Gonnenson to do the digging. And they continue digging, Gonnenson's shovel hitting something and making a clang. Bodell snarks about maybe being a warhead, and the captain glares at him again. Like I said, running gag. They soon uncover the stairway hatch and open it, and Gonnenson sends Kirsten with Calvin escorting her to measure the millireps and see if it's safe to enter. Calvin sneezes a lot because of the dust, and Kirsten determines the place is safe, radiologically speaking, which Calvin radios back. And Tyler says the place looks like a possible independent, inhabitable silo with its own power supply, like ones he's seen before, only those are smaller than this. Tyler also says that there should be no nuclear materials in there, as it's the first thing they do when they shut down silos. And Bodell remarks that there shouldn't be bug-infested hobos down there either. And Gonson is just silently mad about it again. So Kirsten moves Bodell to the back of the line with Tyler. They continue down the tunnel, passing twisted metal debris that looks like shrapnel, and they soon find the way forward has been blocked, presumably detonated when the place was shut down. And there's a small passage 7 feet up the blockage, presumably where Ralph Bernard got out. And once we get past this tunnel area here, we don't really talk about Bernard getting out, what he did, why he did it. If he got out through there, how did he get... Why did they have to dig up the gantry if he tunneled out through this thing? It's a little confusing. It could be a little clarified in a rewrite, maybe. Tyler says that the secondary antechamber with a spiral staircase leading down to the silo should be on the other side, if it hasn't also been collapsed. And so Gjonnason sends Calvin through the tunnel to check things out first, and he has to crawl on its belly because it's so narrow. He observes that the tunnel must have been dug by hand and propped up with whatever could be soldered together, which must have taken years. He continues down the tunnel and sees two white dots in the distance, the reflections from eyes. Reporting back all the while, Calvin tries to communicate with whatever is watching him, only for it to lunge at him, revealing a cat-sized, bald rat covered in lesions. So, ooh, we're getting into the monster movie side of this. This is fun. Calvin kills the rat, but more show up, and he doesn't have enough ammo to take them all down and begins his retreat. And he makes it back out with Gjonnason pulling him down, but a rat has bitten on his face and is holding on to him. Gjonnason kills the rat with his bare hands and has Robert, with Kirsten's help, tend to Calvin's wound, even though Robert's like, I'm not that kind of doctor. And so Bodell helps Gjonnason load his clips as he prepares to enter the tunnel and deal with the problem, making more sarcastic remarks. He goes into the tunnel, and that's when Calvin warns Bodell to stop antagonizing the captain, as they had served together before in Bosnia, and there was this jokester on the same assignment as them named Richie. And he pissed off Gjonnason enough that once the mission was over and they were on leave, he went looking for him and brutally beat him in the bar, make him crawl outside, after which he was never seen again. Which is, it's like, can you really think they, and Bodell was like, why would the military want to keep a psycho like that? And Kirsten says, really? And the sounds of gunfire indicate that the captain has finished the job, and he soon returns, and they all soon enter the tunnel themselves, dragging their packs behind them. They emerge from the other end in the secondary antechamber, which has the pile of dead rats in the corner. That image is pretty amusing. And so Kirsten checks the millireps and says the levels are higher, but should only pose a problem if they stay in the silo for several months. And Gjonnason sends Bodell to scout ahead down the staircase, and so Bodell just plays along with it, doesn't say anything, because, you know, he remembers that story. And while descending the stairs, he gets caught in some sort of spider web and has difficulty getting free of it, and takes a while to report when Gjonnason calls him over the walkie. He proceeds and soon comes to the end of the stairwell, which breaks off before it reaches the floor. So we're in that tower from Metal Gear Solid 1, where you can't go down because Snake can't just drop down 5 feet. He reports back, explaining about the stairs and saying that the floor below is flooded. Bodell hangs his head down to look for the primary ingress, which is a vault-like door that leads into the body of the silo, and determines that the water is roughly 2 feet deep. Gjonnason sends Calvin down to help him, and while he waits, Bodell hears a child's voice whisper, "Help us!" and radios back to make sure Gjonnason didn't radio him. The whispering voices would be super creepy if executed properly, especially when you find out what they're coming from later on. Oh boy. And Calvin soon arrives and sets up a line to climb down into the water. He and Bodell observe that the door looks like it was sealed and then blown open again. And so Calvin spins the door central wheel and opens it, the black water pouring out through the open door. It sort of levels off, and so it's not as flooded anymore. Bodell hears the whisper again saying, "Come inside, save us." But Calvin doesn't hear anything. The team soon descends down Calvin's line, and Kirsten takes readings, saying the millireps are noticeably higher, but still nothing to worry about. When questioned, she says this indicates the presence of nuclear materials, but she can't be sure of specifics. Bodell hears another whisper, which according to him is, "We're inside, save us," which nobody else hears. And thinking that he might be cracking, Gjonnason orders Calvin to confiscate his sidearm and tells Tyler to watch him for atypical behavior before they proceed. The six of them enter the entrance passage with a door on the other end that looks like it was blown open from the inside. Kirsten confirms that the readings are only a tiny bit higher, which is when the door behind them slams shut and locks itself. Tyler thinks it may be a failsafe of some sort, but can't explain how it happened with no clear power source. Calvin is ordered to stay behind as he says he can breach the lock and undo the pins one by one while the rest of the group proceeds. And so they find themselves in a rec room where Bodell, for some reason, decides he's going to open the fridge and check it for food. But inside, he finds the putrefied corpses of mutated rats in Ziploc bags, which is just nasty. It's like, even the, I can't do justice to this just talking about it, but the descriptions of this place perfectly convey just the griminess and the dirtiness of everything and just the smell of things. Like, it's almost palpable when reading it, like the smell that's supposed to waft out of that fridge. It's almost palpable the way it's described, like, ooh. And so they descend some stairs to a hallway that Tyler identifies as a residential area with the words, "We were murdered," written on the wall. Calvin radios in that he's setting off the charge, and they hear the explosion before splitting up, with Gonenson and Robert taking the left, while Kirsten, Tyler, and Bodell take the right, searching rooms. And they find empty rooms, others filled with suicides, including gunshots to the head, hanging, etc., and even a woman tied to a bed with knives stuck in her, "Traitor," written on the wall above her. Yeah, that's all insane. Like, it's never really explained what happened in these rooms. Like, you can kind of fill it in a little bit based on the information you are given, but that incident in particular is like a total mystery. And I guess maybe she had some connection to the higher ups or something, and when things went bad, the people went nuts and killed her. That's the only thing I can figure out, but it's crazy. Bodell, Kirsten, and Tyler find a locked door that Bodell kicks down, and he has some trouble doing it, and so there's some banter where it's like, "Oh, you sure you need some help?" And they find three old men inside displaying the symptoms Ralph Bernard did. As Calvin radios in that he was unable to breach the lock, the old men attack and a fight ensues. One vomits liquid on the Bodell while another bites Tyler's wrist, like ripping out the blood vessels and such and mortally wounding him. And Gonson manages to shoot down two of the old men while Robert convinces him to leave one alive to collect information. Tyler dies, telling Kirsten to say goodbye to his wife. And it's one last chess chat with Bodell, where Bodell actually manages to surprise him on one of the moves he was going to use. So that's a nice little character moment there. Bodell freaks out, wanting to take Tyler out of there, but Gonson insists on continuing the investigation, saying that the nuclear material present could mean the lives of thousands, maybe millions of innocents, and even offers to let Bodell settle up with him after the mission is over. And this conversation here, the way Gonson approaches it, makes me think that there was more going on with Richie the prankster that Calvin maybe didn't know about. That maybe there was stuff that happened when he wasn't there. That's what really pissed him off. Because Gonson's still being incredibly patient and going, he's offering him the chance to come after him and fight him. So it leaves an interesting ambiguity there where you're not really sure if he is as psychotic as we're being led to believe. Now, he is definitely pretty fucked up, as we will find out in a minute, but holy crap. So yeah, we basically just got our first like look at Denizens, and it's good, creepy, well-written monster stuff that could have been really nasty and cool if executed properly in the movie. And definitely a different kind of zombie-ish thing here. Not really zombies, but kind of similar to the subgenre. And so Kirsten talks Bodell down, and Robert starts to question the old man who can't speak. However, he and Bodell react to something none of the others can hear, which lends credence to Bodell's story. And Robert asks simple yes and no questions, learning that whoever the old man heard left a hand-shaped burns on him, and that there are more than 20 people like him in the silo. And so Robert and Kirsten try to persuade Gonenson to abort, with Kirsten arguing that the people here are sick and he shouldn't kill them, and Robert saying a larger team can handle this better. Yeah, she's going like, these people are Americans and they're sick. How many people do you want to kill just to, you know, complete the mission? That's a good line. Gonson elects to continue and lets Bodell take Tyler's gun and lead the way, but only fire when I tell you to fire. They continue down the stairs further into the silo, with Kirsten and Robert noticing the spider webs above them, which appear to be shot through with red and black lines like veins. On the landing down below, they come across a one-legged old woman on a crutch, who introduces herself as Ingrid and tells them to follow. She says she's taking them to where the Protected live, despite Gonenson's insistence they head for the nukes. She tells them that two of the warheads became unstable and that the military sealed them up inside to preserve its reputation. And that's really the only thing you find out about the backstory here. I would have liked a little bit more. Like, you don't need to, like, fill the movie full of exposition, mind you, but just a little bit more. There's a specific moment later on where we could have gotten more information, I think, and I'll point it out when we get there. And Ingrid leads them into an octagonal passageway, which Bodell says circles the missile bay. And Robert notices that the passageway behind them has been filled up with the spider webs. And him and Kirsten, they point this out to Gonenson, who orders them to go back, with Robert pushing through the webs. Light explodes in the hall, and Robert falls to the ground, a hand mark burned into his neck. Robert can hear the voices now, too, and he and Bodell say it. They said, "Follow Ingrid, or we will hurt you." Gonenson demands an explanation and shoots Ingrid's crutch out from under her. Another explosion of light occurs, with a red hand mark appearing on Gonenson's face, destroying one of his eyes. Bodell and Robert warn him that the voices say they'll kill him, but Gonenson aims his gun at Ingrid's groin. So yeah, psycho going like, "I can make her talk, blah, blah, blah." Suddenly, an unseen force grabs his wrist, shattering it, and twists his arm around and breaks it until the gun faces his head and it fires it, killing him. Holy shit, that's like some shit you see in the Invisible Man movie, only it's not an Invisible Man doing it in this far. Ingrid gets back up on what's left of her crutch and says the twins want to see them, but Bodell just grabs her and throws her through the webbing, breaking it, and that's pretty funny. The thing about Bodell is that I feel like he's being kind of set up to be the, how should I put it, the Hudson of this movie, to compare it to the cast of Aliens, like the Bill Paxton character. And the thing that this could have done better is that Bodell is all mouth, you know, rambling off jokes. He's you know, wisecracks, jokes, crying, freaking out. And what makes him kind of a cut below Hudson is that Hudson, once he gets his shit together later on in the movie, shows that he is actually a competent Marine and knows what he's doing. He's good at his job. Bodell never really gets that moment, which is one of the that's a problem not just with this, but with a lot of movies that, you know, clearly take a certain amount of inspiration from Aliens. They don't look at how the characterization is done. They just kind of, you know, look at the superficial stuff and throw it in there. But this isn't like one of the worst examples of it. Far from it. There's way worse Aliens inspired movies out there. And so they flee up the stairs, but the old man has been joined by more like him, one of whom has a gun. He shoots Bodell in the leg and glances a shot off Robert's shoulder before the trio flees back down the stairs, heading down a maintenance passage off to the side and locking the door behind them. Kirsten tends to their wounds and they set off down the hallway searching for a way out. Robert and Bodell note that they don't hear the voices in this hallway, and Kirsten speculates that may be because it's an especially thick-walled tunnel designed to withstand a nuclear strike on the silo itself. That's something that's cool about this, is that they make good use of the location here. Zoller really, like, he seems to have at least, he's either done some research or gotten very creative in how he describes this place so that it feels authentic at least. And he makes just good use of all these different aspects of the silo, like all these different locations get a decent amount of play. They soon hear a moaning coming from the direction they're headed. And then I found it a little hard to picture what they're doing here. They shimmy up the walls to the ceiling as it approaches. I guess they're like bracing themselves in the corner or something. And then Bodell's wound starts dripping blood. And I'm not sure what exactly happens here, because suddenly he's just on the floor getting munched on by a mutated dog that like leap up at him and pull him down. It's not clear from the way it's described, which takes one of his eyes before Robert and Kirsten beat it to death with their flashlights. So multiple eye trauma in less than like 15 pages. We sure Lucio Fulci wasn't going to direct this? Obviously he wouldn't have, because he died in what, the 90s, but the joke stands. They hear the door they entered through clang open despite being locked, which is, that actually does make sense. But something walks towards them and they attempt to continue down the hall. Both Robert and Kirsten hear the voices this time telling them to stop, and the footsteps reach them, revealing the animated corpse of Gonenson talking into children's voices. The voices tell them that they'll get hurt if they don't follow, and as the walking corpse spins its head around, which literally turns all the way around Exorcist style, they see that the hole in his head is filled with translucent fibers that connect to the ceiling. That is an incredible image. Could you imagine that effect if it was worked on by someone like Patrick Tatopoulos or any of the other number of great creature effects guys out there? Like, holy crap, that could look amazing. And it's like he's a puppet too. Like, he's a dead corpse and the puppet strings have snaked into his head and are like dangling him around. Ooh, I love the connection there, the possible metaphor, if you will. He's like a puppet on a string. And they follow the corpse back to the octagonal passageway where he died, his backpack still on the floor, near where his brains hit the wall, and that has the medical kit in it from earlier. They're led through a viewing hall with a cracked window through which Robert and Kirsten see the hazy outline of a nuclear missile covered in those fibers. Kirsten points out that the readings have gotten worse and they want to be nowhere near a compromised window like that. That could be a very visually cool image. The just being barely able to see the missile through the haze of the cracks in the window and all like the webbing in the way. I can totally see it in my head. It's awesome. And they are led to a dark enclosure where Gonenson's corpse collapses to the ground. And they meet five of the denizens, pale and hairless people, all mutated in different ways, mostly like the way their limbs are different. One of them, named Victor, forcibly outfits all three of them with what he calls udders, sharp metal tubes that allow for the easy extraction of blood, inserted into a vein after he cleans their skin with his saliva, which is just, ooh. Like, I'm not a germaphobe by any means, but just that image of the dude sticking something in your arm after he fucking spits on it. The dude's been living in this fucking nuclear silo for decades. Oh my god, that's nasty. That might be the most disgusting thing in this script. I'm including some of the stuff that's coming up. Okay, they're placed in an antechamber referred to as the waiting hall. And soon the twins beckon the denizens to bring Robert to them. Victor opens a vault door. Now, this is the only one he can... They need to physically open this door. So I'm guessing that the twins are doing this as, like, you know, it's part of, like, the ritual. They're forcing them to do this to, like, serve them. Because we know from earlier they can spin these wheels with their minds. And that they could open that locked door in the hallway with their minds. So they could easily do it if they wanted to, but they feel like being assholes, is my interpretation of this. And they lead Robert into the den of webs, which is filled with those fibers. Victor leaves, and the fibers part to reveal a pair of mutated fetuses, pale and sexless, whose heads are peeled open, the fibers sprouting from the holes. Now, I'm going to try and find the description of them to read it off. I'm going to read it off verbatim, because I think it's a really good description. Robert walks forward, his shoes pressing into the downy film covering the floor. The nets immediately before him open up to reveal the twins. Suspended upon a sheer net of fibers are two malformed fetuses, whitish-green in coloring. Their blank eyes are bulbous, opaline spheres. They are sexless. The tops of their oversized heads lie open, peeled back like flower petals. A mass of ropey gray tendrils sprout from their open skulls and branch into slenderer arteries and veins and eventually into the thousands upon thousands of glassine fibers that fill the room and the silo. That is insane. Now, this is a scene where I feel like we could have gotten just a little bit more background on the silo, because these are psychic fetus things that can project words into people's minds. Would it not be too much of a leap to have them project like a couple images, maybe go like this happened, blah, blah, blah. Not for like super long. It doesn't need to be super, super long, like the fucking Dark of Lots of voiceover in the Silent Hill movie. Just like a couple images going like, blah, blah, blah. It was not a conventional missile. It was like an experimental type of fuel they were using or something that leaked and created us. And we were born. They freaked and then covered it all up. You know, something like that. Just a little bit to cover, fill in some of the gaps here. And maybe have them mention, you know, they know Ralph Bernard got out. Although, I think it's assumed that Bernard was one of the guys outside of the area where the denizens live. So that's probably like a different tribe or whatever. So the twins weren't concerned with him. I don't know. I'm a little spotty on that part. And they command Robert to spill his blood on the floor. And after he sheds the amount they want, the blood is telekinetically drawn up the fibers to the one twin's mouth. And the other mouthless, this is also up there with nasty, is fed by a tube that connects to its sibling's anus to its stomach. So they're not quite connected ass to ass. Like, ooh, that's like, ooh, like human centipede nasty. Like, ooh. And as he leaves the den, Robert notices that there's another exit on the other side of the room behind the fibers. And back in the waiting hall, Kirsten is taking to the twins next. And I'm like, you just fed. You're some greedy bitches. While Robert gets an idea, he talks Victor into letting him check Gonson's backpack for medical supplies to treat Bodell. And Victor is just like, yeah, if you try to trick us, I'm going to geld you with my bare hands. And throughout all of this sequence, they are referred to as cows. Like the little shunts in their arms are udders, and they are referred to as cow. It's Idris. I'd be curious as to how this kind of sprang up. Is that how the twins decide to frame everything? I'd be curious to know how it came to be and how they like, why like the denizens are so like, I guess they hate the outside world because the outside world left them to rot. So they think of them as being no better than animals. While treating Bodell's wounds, and there's this whole thing during the sequence where like the one denizen has Gonenson's gun and is pointing the laser sight at his dick. He's like, could you calm down? I gotta treat this guy. I can't do it under that amount of stress. And so Victor's like, okay, point the gun away, which is kind of funny. Robert sneaks Bodell. He sneaks him a vial of tranquilizers, telling him to mix it with his blood. And Kirsten soon returns, and Bodell crawls through the vault door because of his wounds into the den. And Kirsten laments that, you know, if I disappear and go missing, you know, I don't really have any family. There's no one left who it would make a difference to if I died. And she assumes Robert misses his wife. And that's when he tells her the full story, that the marriage seemed to be going well until he found out that she carried on an affair for a whole year. And they've been going to marriage counseling, but it isn't really working. And Kirsten, and I find this kind of amusing, she just goes like, you know what, if we make it out of here alive, let's go to a motel. Because, you know, I really want to get pregnant because, you know, she's now lamenting her lack of a family. I think that's fun. I like the fact that they're not presented as like a serious romantic interest. It's just, yeah, if we get out of here alive, let's fuck. Like, it feels so realistic to the situation to me. Like, I don't know. I like that it wasn't like melodramatic or anything. It's just, you know, let's bang. And so in the den, Bodell sneaks the tranquilizer into his blood as he spills it. You know, some psychics these fucking things are, if they can't see that coming. Which is a bit of a flaw here, that these super psychics who can control the entire vault can't tell that he's got a fucking vial with him. They can't read his thoughts and go, hey, what the fuck are you doing? And he purposely lags behind when the twins tell him to leave, despite them leaving a hand mark on him. And the left twin with the mouth starts to shiver and shake. And the right twin looks at Bodell as they send out the psychic message that the cows have poisoned us. Bodell gets to his feet, and despite one of the fibers strangling him, he grabs the left twin. And ooh, this is like Zoller violence to the nth degree. He yanks the fibers from its head, which dislodges all of its organs as well. Like, it just rips the entire like system out of it. Like, oh my God. And he like collapses to the floor under the strain from the thing choking him, just as the vault door squeaks open and Victor enters. And they keep emphasizing that this door squeaks every time they open and close it. And so as Victor leaves, Robert and Kirsten fight back against the denizens guarding them, with Robert going for the one wielding the gun, which goes off and wounds a knife-wielding woman, whose knife unfortunately falls into Kirsten's calf. Nice job fixing it there, Robert. And so Robert bashes the denizen's head in and shoots the leg out from under another before Victor returns and blindsides him, knocking him to the floor. And in the den, Bodell manages to get to his feet and get to the last twin, who has threatened the denizens with blinding them if they don't stop the cows before he suffocates, grabbing and crushing its brain with his bare hand. However, he is caught in its death throes, and he gets thrown down, and his skull gets bashed open on the floor, which kills him. And his brains, like, spew everywhere. Ugh, that's a nasty death. So yeah, that's fucking gnarly horror stuff right there. We get the creepy-ass monsters with their organs getting ripped out, their brains getting crushed, which is going to lead to a weird moment later that I don't quite follow. But yeah, and then the dude accidentally gets his head bashed open. Ugh! And back in the waiting hall, Kirsten jumps Victor as he grapples with Robert, hitting him with the knife that landed in her leg. And then the two of them, oh my God, this is both violent and funny as hell. They manage to pin Robert in the vault door, and Kirsten spins the wheel with one locking pin going through his chest and the other one going through his head. And she turns the wheel back, and the door no longer squeaks because it's been lubricated by his blood. Ah, that's so funny. And she sees that Bodell has died, and Robert mentions the other exit he saw inside the den, which she says must lead to the launch bay. And hearing the denizens crying out in anger, they head into the den. Now, this is something I want to talk about because they never bring it up again after, like, they're describing Ralph Bernard. But the lesions that are filled with insects, they never address the unknown species of insect. Were they, presumably they were mutated by the unstable nuke leaking the radiation. But I would have liked to see those come up again. Like, there's one moment where they open the door in the living area and they see a bunch of roaches on the ground. But I don't know if those are supposed to be the same ones. I would have liked to come back to that and maybe tie it in a little bit more. And so they head past the twins and Bodell's corpse and into the doorway, and they find themselves in a crawl space and can make out sunlight in the distance. Kirsten and Robert soon emerge into the launch bay where the missile is covered in the fiber webbing, and the hatch at the top has been partly open. Despite the dangers of physical proximity to the leaking missile, they see no other choice but to climb up the siding by clinging to the webbing and find that corpses have been suspended from it, the fibers emerging from every orifice. And there's one corpse where they literally describe every orifice that has fibers emerging from it, which is maybe a little more detail than I needed to know. And the denizens arrive in the launch bay and start climbing up the missile after them, getting Robert under the shoulder blade with a crude harpoon. And I'm like, who put Captain Ahab in the fucking missile silo? And meanwhile, the twin whose head was crushed is apparently only mostly dead. Like I said, I don't really understand how this has happened. And starts convulsing in the den. It sends out signals down the fibers, which animates one of the corpses suspended there. And it attacks Kirsten and tears like the blood vessels right out of her throat. And she dies. And her falling body scatters the climbing denizen. A shocked Robert pulls the Harpoon 3 and starts climbing again and looks up to see that a helicopter is now hovering over the partially open hatch. A voice calls down to Robert and it turns out to be Calvin, who is leaning over the edge of the hatch. He helps Robert climb out of the launch bay where military transports and a 5-man team in radiation suits are waiting. Calvin explains that by the time he got the door open, communications were cut off, and when he found Tyler's body, he fled the silo and called for help. I like this because I almost forgot all about Calvin before, by the time we got to this point. So when he pops up at the end, it's like, oh, cool, that guy. And then the hatch opened up and the entire country went on high alert. And a full-scale invasion of the silo was in preparation when activity was detected down below. And so the men in radiation suits start throwing gas bombs down the hatch. And Robert is soon met by Harry and Dillett. And he starts talking to them, going, what are you doing? What are you doing? And they think he's going to be, like, all arguing, like, oh, we shouldn't kill them, blah, blah, blah. But then he surprises them, and I want to read the dialogue out, actually, because it's honestly pretty good, if I can find it. There is something in there that you should be made aware of. Two fetuses that mutated, that grew into something strange and very, very dangerous. Major Dillett and Harry exchange befuddled glances. The major then looks at Robert. You want us to try and save these fetuses? No, we tried to kill them, and I think we did. Just make sure that they are really dead. When you find them, pulverize and incinerate them, and afterwards, shoot their ashes into the fucking sun. Major Dillett and Harry stare at Robert, unsure whether he is completely sane. Harry looks at Calvin and nods. I like that dialogue. He then heads for a transport and looks back at the tendrils of smoke billowing out of the hatch, which is a really cool, once again, really cool image. In fact, the tendrils of the smoke, similarly described to the tendrils that are all over the silo. Interesting visual similarity there. And so it cuts ahead to sometime later, and Robert is in therapy with a psychiatrist named Dr. Fleischman, talking about how his wife decided to leave him while he was gone and has now left him without waiting for him to finish recovering. And Fleischman, who doesn't share Robert's disdain for dream analysis, and I like this dialogue here because I like the dialogue between two professionals in the same field who have different approaches, the way they're able to intelligently discuss it. I like that. And so he asks him about the recurring nightmare he's been having. Robert goes into the details. He walks naked down the hallway like those in the silo. The floor has a texture that leaves glyphs on his. He soon finds himself in a room with a table, and on the table is a fishbowl with two transparent, mouthless fetuses in it, floating in the water. They psychically tell Robert, one day we will crack open your skull and be reborn. Robert then tells Fleischman about the last night before Laura left. He was laying in bed awake at 4:43 a.m. while she was asleep on her side. He clicks on the bedside lamp and he looks over and he sees on her back, burned through her outfit, a hand-shaped burn mark, and it ends. That's an interesting ending. It is kind of a cliche, oh no, the horror survived ending. And I'm likening it to the ending of, I don't want to give away too much about this movie if you haven't seen it, but John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness ends on a similar note of we stopped it, but did we stop it? And it ends on just this great ambiguous final image. It's just one of the most perfect endings to a movie. And it also involves a dream sequence at the end too. It's not as good as that because I feel like I'm a little, that was ambiguous enough that it works. This is a little too leaning on the side of, oh, it definitely survived. Because unless I'm meant to think that him next to his wife in bed is also part of the dream, I just don't understand how it got out. Because did it, like, the only thing I can think of is that either those smoky tendrils were like its essence escaping, or that it knew it had a link to him because Kirsten didn't have one. And it had a link to him because he walked through the spider webs, and that it killing her and dropping her body on the denizens, was it deliberately trying to save some part of itself? So it deliberately set him up to escape in the ending there. That's the only, I'm a little fuzzy on just because I'm not sure of the mechanics, but it's not a bad ending. It's a haunting image to end the movie on. And this would have been, if it got made, it might have been an interesting little horror movie if it had the right director behind it, if they didn't meddle too much with the script in the wrong ways, like, as I said, happened with Asylum Blackout. But I can see this if you really worked on the characters just a little bit more, maybe put in a little bit more of the backstory, tied in the bugs. It would take a very small revision to really, really fix, to really, really make this the ideal version of it. And on the whole, I can say, oh, it gets a thumbs up. It's not perfect, but it was an enjoyable read and would be a pretty interesting movie. Now, I don't know what happened with this, if it was a spec that just didn't go anywhere, or if because it was at Spitfire and they didn't do anything after a 4-year period that they just didn't get around to it. But I will say it's also not my favorite Zoller script. I will say there's quite a few I like more, but this isn't one of there's two I'm kind of iffy on, which I'm not going to say what they are in case I cover them, you know, keep the surprise in place. But there's two I'm kind of iffy on. Everything else I think is either good or really good, and this is one of the good ones. So yeah, that was Silo, Denizens of Filth, and I hope you enjoyed it. Hope this was a nice, informative listen. It was a fun listen. I'm sorry if you were really looking forward to the Mummy episode, because that might not be coming out for a while now. And hopefully you just had fun with this, and until next time, bye!